So I'll start off by chanting the four vowels. Anyone that knows it is welcome to join in.
Shigur Segan Mo On Shujo
carrying on the theme of what I spoke about last time, about the Zen approach to ethics and morality, which of course is connected with the Buddhist philosophy on ethics and morality, but it does have different Buddhist schools place different emphases and have a different kind of relationship with this, so there are some differences between the Zen perspective and other schools. When one receives ordination, one takes a number of precepts, which are commitments in one's life. We do the four vows, the Bodhisattva vows, which we've just chanted. That's part of ordination. And there are 16 other precepts. There's three precepts of refuge, which are to do with taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Then there are the three... what's it called? The three pure precepts, which kind of summarize one's attitude to ethics in its entirety. And that's what I spoke about last time. The three pure precepts are basically don't do harm, try to do good, and act for the benefit of all of humanity and all of existence. And what I wanted to speak today about is about the 10 precepts, what's called the great precepts, which follow on from that. And those, the three pure precepts, are, if you like, encompass everything. They really are one's attitude of mind with regard to one's relationship with others and with life. They encompass everything. The great precepts are more specific, and they are intended to help focus one's mind in the places where people make mistakes most often. I remember going to a talk about Buddhist philosophy and ethics. Not only Buddhist, he was Eastern ethics. He was kind of talking about that. He was talking about Buddhism and Hinduism. And he made the point that when there has been a rule made, it's usually because someone in the community broke it. So you only create rules for things that people have made mistakes around. So the three pure precepts are kind of the encompassing all of one's attitude. Three pure precepts can accompany all of one's attitude. And then over the years, at the time of Buddha, and maybe also later, there were areas where people made mistakes. And so the Buddha and the people who came after said, pay more attention to this. And interesting historical side note... I wish I could remember the details of this, and I don't remember exactly who told me. It was a woman who was studying. There's one thing that was happened in the Buddha's time is that women ended up having to have more precepts than men. And there was one very particularly strange one, which was not to do with not growing a particular plant or something like that. And it was something to do with that one of the nuns maybe had been making money by growing this plant and selling it. It was some very, very precise thing. And then that had got encoded in the rule system. So the thing about these rule systems, and this is true of all engagement with rules, the spirit behind the rules can get lost. We can forget that there was some spirit thing, there was something going on there that created a rule, and then the spirit behind it got lost. The reason, fundamental reason behind it, got lost, which is one of the reasons why we have the pure precepts. The pure precepts are always to remind us that the spirit behind any more precise guidance is don't do harm, try to do good, and try to act for the benefit of all beings. That's, if you like, that's everything. And so anything else, though anything else comes beyond that. And as I said, there was lots of rules in the Buddha's time. And in fact, the Buddha caused a bit of confusion and debate by, towards the end of his life, saying to his disciples, well, when I die, you can get rid of half the rules, if you like, but didn't say which ones. So, of course, that was a great, you know, kind of reason for schism, etc. And sure enough, that sort of thing happened. So Dogen, in that spirit, I'm not sure if it was Dogen or his teacher, but certainly around that time in Zen, they stripped out, so the traditional Vinaya has hundreds of rules that are expected of monks, etc. And Dogen, it happened in the Zen tradition, either almost as Dogen received transmission in China, or it was Dogen himself, I just don't remember, I think it is known, that a lot of these were stripped away, and in Dogen's ordination, there were only the three taking refuge vows, the three pure precepts, and the 10 great precepts. He stripped away everything else, or someone shortly before him stripped away everything else. So it was kind of cut down in terms of what you could and couldn't do. And there were some historical reasons for that. Earlier on, the Zen monks in China had already got rid of the rule that was existed in India about farming, but monks weren't allowed to farm in India. And were expected to beg for their existence, whereas in China it was a different culture. Begging was not so much part of the culture as it was in India. In India there was a tradition of spiritual practitioners being supported by the community, which didn't exist in China. And so in China, the monks moved to a system where they tried to support themselves rather than relying on the community. They still received donations from the community, but a lot more. There was a lot more kind of self-support that went on, which is why they dispensed with the farming rule. And as many of you will know, that the classic quote from one of the early Zen practitioners, a day without work is a day without food. And so the idea that in Zen, unlike the original Buddha path, work is actually an important part of our practice, as opposed to begging. We still do, in Japan, they still do begging. But nowhere near to the same extent and for different reasons than it was done in India. So that's the kind of background. So the great precepts. The great precepts are the areas where people make most mistakes. And so therefore the areas where we need most awareness. And as I said about the pure precepts are a call to awareness. And the practice of Zazen allows us to be aware of the ways in which we make mistakes. That's effectively what. That's not the only thing about Zazen, but that's, I've spoken last week about concentration and observation. Concentration, opening and abandoning oneself to something beyond the ego, and observation, noticing the way in which the ego makes mistakes, effectively, are the two parts of our practice. So the precepts help us notice the ways in which our ego makes mistakes. And so from a Zen point of view, because these are... each precept is a point of awareness as opposed to a rule, then it must be such, though to turn it into a rule is to, from a Zen point of view, to turn it into a strict rule is to stifle awareness. And so we don't use these precepts as strict rules. That doesn't mean that we don't create strict rules in our life. So a good example would be maybe someone who is an alcoholic needs a strict rule to never touch alcohol. So it's not, doesn't mean, but it's done with an awareness. It's not done with simply naivety that if I follow this rule, then I'm a good person. That's not part of what Zen is about. So going into what the rules are, the non-rules, the points of awareness, the precepts. The first, as with many traditions, is not to kill, to protect and to value life. And so it is to be aware of the ways in which our sustenance feeds off others. So through whether it's food, whatever it is, the way that we receive, is effectively feeding off others and can cause death to others, whether it be animals, whether it even be humans involved in exploited supply chains and all these things. So not to kill, not to directly kill, and to protect life and to be aware of the ways in which our actions, our choices, can cause death in the world. And of course it's harder nowadays. Back in the Buddha's time, you would be viscerally connected with the reality of your meals because you'd be in a village and everything would go on in the village. Whereas nowadays, the supermarket supply chain stretches throughout the world. So we're far more disconnected from an awareness of the way in which our choices have an impact on others. So not to kill is the first thing. So being aware and protecting life, valuing life in the way we talk, the choices we make, etc. The second one is not to steal, not to take which is not ours. And it is not only the obvious thing, like not half-inching a box of paper clips from work or whatever. It's also, and in some ways more importantly, thinking about the ways in which we take from others in more subtle ways. And a good example of that is, you know, maybe taking credit for something someone else did. So the way that our ego, this is all to do with the way that our ego plays out in the world. How does our ego grasp for things, and in that grasping, take things away from those around us? That's what it is. Whether it's material stuff, whether it's one that I have a problem with is that my unaware tendency is to be quite sort of grabbing for food, and so, you know, am I going to grab for food and deprive the people around me of their fair share? That sort of thing. And so being aware of the ways in which our grasping, taking, can deprive others of what is in some sense rightfully theirs, which it's fair for theirs. So being aware of that, being aware of the ways, as I say, in which maybe we can take credit for what others do as well. So you can actually take ideas, take honour from other people, because your ego craves that. Each of us has different things that our ego is particularly attracted to, and it will tend to be that we might take it from others. And so by noticing what we take from others helps us understand ourselves in the process, and that act of understanding will actually make it less likely we take from others, and therefore will make it more harmonious the way in which, and we will help fulfill the first pure precept of not causing harm to others through that. So that's the second one. The third one, which Nancy in her inimitable style translated as no bad sex. Effectively, that is, the way in which we express our sexuality should be done in a way which does not cause suffering for those around us. And, of course, traditionally, in the monastic community, that was through abstention. But it doesn't mean abstention, necessarily. It means not to cause harm and suffering. And also, not to fool ourselves that just because other people around us seem to be in agreement with what we do, we're not causing harm and suffering. So we can cause harm and suffering by effectively exploiting others' weakness equally, in a sexual way and in other ways, of course. So expressing one's sexuality in a way which doesn't cause harm for others, and also which doesn't cause harm for ourselves. So it's not proscriptive about what is is not appropriate, but it means that whatever is expressed is done in a way that doesn't cause harm for others. And one thing to say is that being abstentive or being overly abstentive or forcing, I would say one way of causing harm, which maybe occurs in some traditional religious communities, is to force an idea of badness about sexuality on younger children, on children, the idea. So that is effectively way that, if you like, something that is traditionally considered the right way, can actually cause a lot of damage. So that is again, that is bad sexuality. If by creating guilt on others around you, particularly those who are less experienced in life, then that is another way of causing harm through sexuality. So we must express our sexuality in a way which enhances life in ourselves and in others. So the fourth way is to protect the truth. Don't lie, and don't hide the truth, or express the truth appropriately. I shouldn't say don't hide the truth, but don't distort the truth and express the truth appropriately. Again, it is, in what ways do we use our relationship with truth and falsehood to bolster our ego? How does our ego play its games out through the way in which we talk about what's true and what's false? So a really good example, I can see it in myself sometimes, is that you just might exaggerate something just slightly to make yourself look better. See what I mean? That's just that you can feel that tendency arising. And it's not even necessarily conscious. You can just kind of, just this slight exaggeration which makes you look better than maybe actually the reality was. You know? And I think we all do that. There was some count of the number of times people lie in a day, and it's remarkably high. And I think, you know, for us not to lie, even if we think we don't, we probably do. Yeah. And so noticing that, the way in which we can, and even what are called white lies, which is effectively, do we lie to others in a way to kind of move things forward, do you want to go out for a drink tonight? Oh no, I'm really busy. Well, actually, the truth is, I'd just rather not spend time with you. Maybe it's best you don't say, I'd rather not spend time with you, I don't like you. That might not be appropriate either. But maybe you do it away with that lying, you know, that sort of thing. So noticing the ways that we avoid conflict, avoid putting ourselves in slightly awkward positions by taking the easy way out. These are all ways that our ego can get caught up in the game of truth and lying. Another way, of course, is by telling the truth too bluntly, being too honest in a way that hurts. And again, you can use the truth in a way that hurts other people, in the same way that you can use lies to hurt other people. You can use the truth in a way that's designed as a weapon, again, as an act of ego towards others. So all these things are ways in which we can get kind of caught up in these, how our ego plays out through its relationship with the truth and falsity. So that's the fourth one, protect the truth. The fifth one is don't trap your mind with poisons. And I think Master Deshima translated it as something like, don't drink the wine of delusion. And the traditional interpretation of this is avoid alcohol and intoxicants. So that's the kind of traditional thing, that a Theravadan monk would not drink alcohol, would not drink coffee, etc., avoid alcohol and drunks. From a Zen point of view, how does our relationship with these things, again, get caught up in our ego, get tangled up? How do we use alcohol as an escape? Noticing how we use it as an escape, how do we use it? I must say it's coffee, the morning coffee. You know, that's to an extent something that I become slightly dependent on, probably not in a good way. How do we kind of get tangled up in these things and they become something that there's a need there when maybe there shouldn't be? How do these things take us away from awareness? How does our relationship with alcohol or any other form of intoxicant take us away from being aware and being present? And how can we create a relationship where that doesn't happen? Again, it doesn't mean abstinence, it just means creating a healthy relationship. Though sometimes a healthy relationship requires abstinence for some people who have an addictive connection with something, then the right thing to do is to cut. But not for everyone. And also for that, because Deshimaru interpret this also as being about one's relationship with ideas. If we become intoxicated by ideas, that is also not a good thing. So ideas are intoxicating, or can be intoxicating in our relationship with them. If we become overly attached to an idea, in the same way that we become overly attached to alcohol, an ideology, a particular belief, etc. Zen is about, even though we firmly commit to certain practices, it's about creating a relationship where, I think I quoted the Buddha, Nagarjuna, who says, I pay homage to the Buddha who taught the abandoning of all views. So it's basically being able to not grasping an idea and allowing that idea to control you, whatever that idea is. And so having a certain openness in one's relationship with these things, whether it's politics, and there's nothing wrong with being involved in politics, but doing it in such a way that it becomes blinding to one and one's relationship with others is not good. So that's the fifth one. Don't trap your mind with poisons. Sixth one, don't speak ill against others. And I remember Nancy saying, this is the one that she found hardest, don't criticise others. She said not to criticise, that's the one I find hardest. So the desire to criticise often comes from ego. Not necessarily, I was just thinking about in Nancy's case. It wasn't, in her case, her desire to put down the other person. That's not where it came from. In her case, it was the desire to make things work right and how she felt it should be. So there was still an element of ego there, and she was acknowledging that. It was to that things, she had a clear idea of how things should be, and if someone stepped outside that, she would criticise. Yeah, that sort of thing. And it wasn't necessarily inappropriate always. But it's noticing how our criticism of others arises from ego. And I'll say in my case, I would say that I almost have the opposite problem in that I'm less likely to criticise other people because I'm scared of the reaction, which is also an egoic tendency. So noticing again our relationship with how we connect with others to provide guidance to them, whether it's overly harsh or not harsh enough, whatever. These are all things that can happen. So if there is something that needs to be brought out for the good of all, because sometimes it's necessary to say to someone something, it's necessary to guide them in some way, whether it's from a position of authority or a position of equality, depending on the situation, one's children or whatever. How can it be done in such a way that it is truly for the good of all, for the good of that person, for the good of oneself, and for the good of the community, not an act of ego? That's really the key question. And so doing it in such a way that it can be done skillfully and letting go of ego in the process. So the next one, number seven, I'm rattling through them because we've got 10 to get through, whereas last time it was only 3. Number seven, don't get tangled up in pride. Don't be full of pride. I can't read my writing. So finding one's view of oneself beyond ego. So effectively stepping beyond the personal ego to see oneself and what is one's capacities, one's inadequacies, etc., and accepting them. That's what it is. And so pride is one side of it. Of course, feeling that one is crap is also the other side of that. And we all at times feel how great we are, and at other times we feel how awful we are. And both of those are illusions. You know, we just are. For most of us, I mean, there might be some people who are really fantastic. There might be some people who are really evil. But most of us, we're not. Yeah. And so every time we feel how fantastic we are, or we feel how crap we are, it's probably the ego playing games. And so trying to have a relationship with ourselves in such a way that we accept our strengths and our limitations and feel okay with them. And feel okay that it is okay for us just simply to be part of the community that we're in. We don't need to be something special, and being the Eeyore among the community is also a way of being special. So we just simply be in the community, offer what we have, and do the best we can. So don't get tangled in pride. Number eight, give. Cultivate generosity and openness to others. So give what we have to others. Don't allow our ego to hold back too much. Again, trying to... So there's always the idea in Zen of giving without selfishness. So the act of gift itself can be an act of selfishness. But trying to give appropriately to others. Be open to people's needs. Giving not as a way of controlling people, not as a way of looking good, etc. And in all these cases, just simply being aware, because none of us are perfect when these things do happen. If we are giving in a way that maybe is slightly controlling, noticing it. If we notice it, then it will have less power over us next time. So it's all these things are guides to awareness, that, as opposed to rules. They're guides to awareness. Watch in your life. So cultivating generosity and openness to others. Number 9, anger. Observe one's anger and don't let it dominate oneself. Anger is one of the 3 poisons that the Buddha spoke about that can dominate us and destroy our relationship, cause suffering for ourselves and for others. So observe the way that we express anger, observe the way that anger arises in us. Don't let it either fester and dominate ourselves inside without ever being expressed in a way that's appropriate, and don't let it just flood out on other people in a way that causes harm for them, even if we feel good afterwards. Yeah, so create a relationship with anger which allows it to enter in the world in a way which disempowers it from being the master. So it becomes purely a natural flow which doesn't have the strength of a volcano. It just becomes a stream. Yeah, that sort of thing. And so observing it, as we always with Zen, observing it inside us and observing how it comes out into the world and observing it in others is the way that these things, that we create a different relationship with these things. And then finally, number 10, which actually goes back to the refuge. It says, protect and honour Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. Which means, effectively, and this is all the other 9, even if you're not a Buddhist, you can do quite easily. See what I mean? All the other 9, you can come here and not feel that you are a Buddhist, but nonetheless feel that what Chris says is all right and makes sense. Number 10 is slightly more, because it basically says, protect and honour Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. And what that means is, protect and honour Buddha means treat the Buddha's teachings as worth following, and effectively take them as a guide in one's life. Protect the Dharma means to protect life and existence as a whole. And finally, protect the Sangha means to... So I would say also protect the Dharma also means to practice. It means to practice our Zen regularly. That's again what makes one a Zen Buddhist, is that you practice your meditation regularly. So protect the Dharma is to keep the Dharma alive through the practice of Zazen, through the practice of chanting, through the practice of eating together, through the practice of working together. All these are parts of protecting the Dharma. And finally, protecting the Sangha means doing one's best to create a harmonious community, building a community together, interacting with each other in a way which, to quote Master Deshimaru, harmonize like milk and honey. He was probably quoting someone before him, but harmonize like milk and honey was one of his key phrases. Creating a sangha where, despite our differences, despite our different opinions, despite our different characters, etc., nonetheless, we work together, we knock the jagged edges off each other by being together on a regular basis. And that is what builds, that is what in the end the 10th precept is about, protecting the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. So that is the 10 precepts rattled through. To give you some flavour, the key message is these are guidelines to awareness, guidelines to putting into practice the pure precepts of not causing harms to others, doing things which benefit others, and working for the harmony of all human beings, all beings whatsoever, and all existence. And that's really what it is about. And the final thing I want to say is that, to emphasise once more, that it's about awareness, not about rules. And that is why, from the Zen point of view, unlike some other Buddhist traditions, the practice of Zen meditation and the following of the rules are considered, following the precepts are considered an integrated practice. The practice of meditation helps one be aware of the ways in which one makes mistakes in life. And therefore one's life becomes a little bit harmonious. And the harmonious life, a harmonious personal life, As the one's life becomes a little bit more harmonious, as the Sangha becomes a little bit harmonious, it means practice is easier. And so you get a virtuous circle. Practice and meditation helps one lead a life which is more harmonious for both oneself and for those around us. Leading a life which is harmonious helps one make the time and space to practice, make the time and space to be together with the others in the Sangha, all these things. Makes the time and space to one to be together in good ways with those beyond the community of practitioners, whether it's at work, whether it's in the family, etc. And so these things, they feed together. The practice of Zazen and awareness of the precepts can create a virtuous circle through practice. So I will stop talking then. That was because I had to get through all 10. I kind of rattled through rather more quickly. So we will finish by chanting the four vows again, okay?
Shigo Segan Mo On Shujo Muhen Segan Do Bono Mujen Segan Dan Ho Say.